Dear me, dear me, dear me. The Supreme Court of the State of South Dakota, the Honorable David Gilbertson presiding, is now open for the transaction of any business that may legally come before it.
Good morning. The first case for oral argument this morning is Kyle Lewis versus the South Dakota Department of Transportation and Bureau of Personnel. For the appellant state is Timothy Engel, an attorney from Peer, and for the appellee Lewis is John Stanton Dorsey, an attorney from Rapid City. Justice Zinner has disqualified himself in this case, and the court has appointed the Honorable Janine Kern, a judge from the 7th Judicial Circuit, to sit in his place. Mr. Engel, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor, and good morning. May it please the court and counsel. There are a number of issues presented by the state's appeal, but in the interest of time, I intend to concentrate on three main issues, unless, of course, you have questions that I'd be happy to address if you do. The three issues I intend to address are interrelated in such a way that they strongly reinforce the conclusion that the department and the circuit court erred when they ruled that the state is amenable to attorney fee awards in workers' compensation cases. And, of course, these would be limited to state employee workers' compensation cases. The three issues are, one, whether the legislature intended to make the state amenable to attorney fee awards when it amended 58-12-3 in 1988. Two, whether the state is immune from attorney fee claims in state employee workers' compensation cases under the doctrine of sovereign immunity. And three, whether the cap on attorney fee awards, which is contained in SDCL 62736, would apply in these circumstances. And with the court's permission, I will address these in order and discuss the interrelationship among the three. First, I would submit to the court that it is plain that the legislature did not intend to make the state amenable to attorney fee awards when it amended SDCL 58-12-3 in 1988. This court stated quite clearly in Ofsted versus Department of Transportation that the state and other self-insured employers were not amenable to attorney fee awards at, under 58-12-3 as it existed prior to 1988. In 1988, this court has said since Ofsted, and particularly in Schuldes versus Miller, which is 1996 SD 120, this court has stated that it rigorously follows the rule that the authority to assess attorney's fees may not be implied, but must rest upon a clear legislative grant of power. When the legislature amended 58-12-3 in 1988, it specifically excluded the state as an employer that was subject to attorney fee awards. Prior to the 1988 amendment, 58-12-3 discussed employers and workers' compensation cases that had insurance. The legislature in 1988 added the phrase, and employers who are self-insured pursuant to SDCL 62-5-4. In 1988, the state was expressly immune or excluded from the operation of 62-5-4. It was exempt. And as a matter of fact, that's pursuant to the provisions of 62-5-6, and it still says that today. So, I think it's abundantly clear that in 1988, the legislature did not intend to make the state amenable to attorney fee awards. I think the court can infer that the legislature had the Ofsted decision in mind at that time. And also, if the legislature had intended to make the state amenable to attorney fee awards, it simply could have left out the reference to 62-5-4 and discussed employers that are self-insured. Or
doesn't,
some other context.
Doesn't 62-5-6, however, exempt the state from the necessity of proving financial solvency? Isn't that what that statute is designed to do?
Well, Your Honor, it does say this state or any municipality need not furnish any insurance or security. But the bottom line is the state was not an employer that was self-insured under 62-5-4 in 1988. It was exempt from those provisions at that time as well. I think what the legislature was intending to do was limit the amenability to attorney's fees to employers that had to meet those requirements of 62.54. Otherwise, there's no reason to make the reference.
But they've since changed that.
Well, and that's the next point I was going to get to, Your Honor. In 1996, the legislature amended certain portions of, well, and specifically 62.5.2 through 5, I believe it was, all having to do with security for self-employed insurers. In other words, if you didn't want to buy insurance, you could provide security that met the requirements of those statutes, pay a fee to the Department of Labor or the Division of Insurance or whomever it is, I'm sorry, I don't recall. And in those circumstances, you would not have to go out and purchase commercial insurance. All of those changes, and by the way, let me stop here and say, in our brief, there's a typographical error. It refers to Chapter 453 of the 1996 session laws, and it should be Chapter 306, Section 2. Which repeals SDCL 62.5.4. In those 1996 amendments, the legislature repealed 62.5.4, changed the security requirements for employers that didn't want to purchase insurance. That's all they did. They didn't change 62.5.6, which exempted the state from those provisions, and they didn't touch 58.12.3. Did nothing with it. When the legislature was finished in 1996, 58.12.3 still said employers who are self-insured pursuant to 62.5.4. What happened after that, of course, was that the Code Commission did its duty and removed the reference to 62.5.4 because it had been repealed. That's how we got to the place we are today, where the 58.12.3 says an employer who is self-insured, there is no more pursuant to 62.5.4. That's because the Code Commission did its duty and removed that reference. Now, as I've said before, this court rigorously follows the rule that a delegation of the authority to award attorney's fees or a grant of that authority must be express. And I would submit to the court that you have two opposites here. In 1988, the legislature quite clearly did not grant the authority to award attorney's fees against the state. In 1996, we have the opposite. There's no indication of an intent on the part of the legislature to authorize attorney fee awards against the state. So I would submit following the standards that this court has adopted for legislative interpretation of statutes, and I think it's clear that the legislature never intended to award or to allow the award of attorney's fees against the state in these circumstances.
So are you saying then, your argument is that in order for someone to get attorney's fees against the statute would actually have to specifically say state in there as opposed to self-insurers?
Your Honor, I think there would have to be some evidence that the legislature intended for that phrase, employers who are self-insured, to include the state. And in fact, the legislative history, looking back at the history of the statutes as adopted, is exactly the opposite.
Counsel, should the court consider legislative history when making this type of a determination?
I think the court should, and it can. I'm not talking about looking back at the testimony of persons in committee or anything like that. I think the court has in the past and can and should look at the history of the progression of legislation, and that's what I'm talking about here. The 1988 amendments quite clearly, from the face of the amendments and from the face of the statute as it was adopted, did not allow for attorney fee awards against the state. And I think then the court can look at the 1996 amendments and see that they had nothing to do with 58.12.3 or the state. Now, I said earlier that I was going to discuss the interrelationship of these three arguments or these three issues. The second issue is whether the state is immune by virtue of the doctrine of sovereign immunity. I would submit to the court that these are interrelated and that the state is immune. The first and second issues are interrelated because, first, the court has said in past cases that In order for there to be a grant of authority to award attorney's fees, that grant must be clear. Secondly, in order for there to be a waiver of sovereign immunity, that must be express. Now, to the extent those are different terms, and I think they may be to some extent, there certainly is no express authorization for an award of attorney's fees against the state. Again, we get back to the same progression of how we got to where we are today, and there's just no indication that the legislature expressly waived the state's sovereign immunity. The second part of that, the second interrelationship then, is also the second part of the test as to the waiver of sovereign immunity. This court has said many times that there must be an express waiver and funds to pay the claim. Now, in this particular case, the question is, are there funds appropriated by the legislature to pay the claim? State employee workers' compensation claims are paid under the statutory scheme that's set out in 312A. It starts at section 34 and it goes on for several sections. 312A, 34, and the sections that follow provide for funding for state employee workers' compensation claims, quote, arising under Title 62, unquote. That's what it provides for. We argued at the department, at the departmental level and at the circuit court, that the limits on fees that are contained in 62.736, which limit attorney's fees and workers' compensation cases to a percentage of the award, we argued that those limits apply here as well. The department said, no, they don't. This is a claim and an award under SDCL 58.12.3, and therefore the provisions of 62.736 don't apply. Well, if that's the case, I would submit to the court, the state is quite clearly immune from these claims because the legislature has not appropriated any funds to pay state employee workers' compensation claims under Title 58. It is only awarded funds to pay claims under Title 62. Now, I think I would submit respectfully that if the court looks at the interrelationship of those three things, I did at least start to puzzle about how could this all fit together? This just doesn't seem right. And I think the answer is, again, respectfully to the department and the circuit court, it's not right. The decision is erroneous. And it's erroneous as a matter of law because, one, there is no clear expression of the authority to award fees. This court has said in the past, in the case, I can't pronounce the name, I believe it's FEIOK, F-E-I-O-K, has said that when determining the intent of the legislature and when determining how to apply a statute, the court is going to look at what the legislature intended and is not going to be limited to the language of the statute. Now, I think, and I realize that that's, the court commonly looks to the plain language of the statute, but that case exists, and I think this is one of those circumstances where the court needs to look at that. And the reason I say that is because, again, the history of 58.12.3, how that relates to 62.5.4 and those statutes, I think shows the opposite of a legislative intent to make the state amenable to attorney fee awards. It didn't intend to do that in 1988. If it did it in 1996, inadvertently, it certainly did not do it intentionally or expressly. So I would submit to the court there is no clear expression of the authority to award fees. There is no express waiver of sovereign immunity. There are no funds to pay the claim. There is this internal inconsistency in the department's ruling. In one sense, it says, no, the state's not immune. In the next section, it says, this is an award under 58.12, which the state and the legislature has not appropriated funds to pay claims under 58.12. As I indicated, the only explanation for all of this is that the department was wrong. And where we're at today, members of the court, is that the result is an award of a fee so far in excess of $24,000 on a claim with at most a few thousand dollars worth of expenses, medical expenses. And with that, Your Honors, unless someone has some questions, I believe I'm finished for now.
Mr. Engel, in the first answer to a claimant's petition, the state admitted that it was self-insured. Is this a judicial admission that binds your client?
Respectfully, Your Honor, no, it's not, for a couple of reasons. One, judicial admissions, well, three reasons. One, the allegation was that the state was a self-insurer or something to that effect. And the state, in the common use of that phrase, is a self-insurer. It doesn't buy insurance from someone else. It doesn't go out and buy commercial insurance. Now, as this court has said, and other courts have said a number of times, that's self-insurance is a bit of a misnomer. But the state, in the common use of that word, is a self-insurer. So one, I don't think that that's that was an error. Two, the fact that the state is a self-insurer doesn't make it a self-insurer under 5812.3, and doesn't mean that the legislature intended to make the state amenable to attorney fee awards. The next point I guess I would make is that if that's an admission, it's an admission as to a legal issue, and judicial admissions can only be admissions of fact, and this court has stated that on several occasions. Specifically in Zahn versus Music, the court has indicated that a judicial admission can only be one of a fact, doesn't apply to legal questions. Finally, I would submit, particularly because the state of South Dakota is a party to this case, as counsel for the state, I don't have the authority any more than any other, an elected official or an appointed official, I don't have the authority to waive the state's sovereign immunity. I don't have the authority to create a remedy as against the state that some other party would not. And this court has recognized that in the high-grade oil case, that by an admission, there is no such thing as an admission or a waiver that would essentially waive sovereign immunity by an official or by me. Only the legislature can do that.
By statute?
By statute, all right. Yes, Your Honor.
If all issues that you've argued so far are determined against you, do you also take issue with the attorney's fees on the basis of their being unreasonable and excessive?
Yes, Your Honor.
And for what reasons?
Primarily, Your Honor, the reason is that the amount that's in dispute in this case is frankly minuscule compared to the amount of fees that have been awarded up to this point. The record shows that the cost for the two veneers that were at issue, the two teeth coverings that were at issue, is $1,100 or $1,200. There's nothing in the record about the cost of the plastic surgery.
Doesn't it take the same number of hours, though, for counsel for an employee to litigate a $2,000 claim as a $20,000 claim?
Oh, I would agree with that, Your Honor. It could take as much time. We do have some quibbles with some specific things in Mr. Dorsey's fee request, and those are set out in the brief. But this court has said time and time again that the overriding question is, what is a reasonable fee given the services rendered and the outcome of the case? And I would submit here that even at a 50% contingency, we're now at $24,000 in fees. This would need to be a $50,000 case for this to be a reasonable fee, and we're nowhere near that. We're not even at a $5,000 case.
One more question. Do you think it's proper in this case for what Lynn Job did? Should she be able to contact the hearing officer Marsh and almost get an ex-party, one-sided opinion under these circumstances?
Well, Your Honor, the best I can respond to that is twofold. One, I think that's a common practice to contact Director Marsh. Not to contact the individual hearing officers, but to contact Director Marsh. Two, Director Marsh didn't hear this case, and I don't think hears many cases. Director Marsh does more administrative work. He does mediation. As a matter of fact, I think he does most or all of the mediations at the department. But I don't believe he hears many cases. I haven't had a case, and I do a lot of this work, haven't had a case that Director Marsh has heard for years and years and years.
So you're saying it's standard practice, but are you saying, is it a proper practice?
I don't think it's inappropriate as long as it's an inquiry to Director Marsh as opposed to an inquiry to Administrative Judge Follenkamp or one of the other judges that actually hears these cases routinely. I think that the Department of Labor, and I've cited some provisions from Larson in my brief, talk about how workers' compensation is supposed to be administered as informally as possible. And that's part of what this is about, is a contact with the department looking for some guidance. And I guess I would point out to the court, too, that she was careful not to use names, careful not to say this is a Department of Transportation employee. She was careful not to use the names of physicians. She made it as generic as she could.
But that was Ms. Jobe's basic defense as far as a good faith turndown, was she relied on the opinion of Mr. Marsh, who potentially then as a witness with one of his subordinates sitting as the ALJ.
That's true.
It's a little bizarre.
This is an unusual case, Your Honor, I agree. I see my time's about up. Thank you.
Thank you, and we'll hear from you again, Mr. Engel. Okay. Mr. Dorsey, you have 20 minutes, sir.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'd like to begin by visiting a little bit about attorneys representing injured people who have been denied these claims. Mr. Lewis comes into my office with a scar running from the corner of his mouth down to his chin. Pictures are in the transcript of the first hearing.
We've seen them.
And immediately after seeing the letters of denial, we filed our petition, and therein we said that the denial was without medical foundation, unreasonable, vexatious, or without any support of the law. And in that document, we asked for a hearing on attorney's fees pursuant to 58.12.3. There's been some issue as to whether or not we should have done that after the initial award within 10 days. One of the reasons that was in there was to alert someone legally trained that might get a hold of this complaint and review it and looking at these facts and say, my gosh, this wasn't denied reasonably. Because the advice that Mr. Marsh gave was wrong. I mean, nothing in 62.41, the statute on reasonable, necessary, or suitable and proper medical expenses, says anything about a disfiguring scar must affect someone's earning capacity. But the fact that Mr. Marsh's advice was wrong wasn't so much the point to the administrative law judge as was the point that Lynn Jobe gave him nothing in terms of the facts upon which she knew to be the case. Dr. Ruth McLaughlin, the doctor in Deadwood, recommended scar revision by the plastic surgeon, Dr. Carver, great name for a plastic surgeon. Dr. Carver strongly recommends this surgery. Yet Ms. Jobe says at the hearing, in spite of her knowledge that that exists, in spite of her knowledge that 62.41 sets the standard for medical necessity, and despite her knowledge that the case of Hansen versus Penrod and its progeny say it's within the doctor's province to decide what's reasonable and necessary, she goes on to deny the claim. The same day that she gets the rather curt and somewhat, I suppose, offhand and some might think funny response from Mr. Marsh on the scar. In the same way, she denies the claim for the dentist. And there's some disagreement as to whether or not there were two veneers or four veneers, but the letter from Dr. Loftus said all of the veneers were damaged.
Does she have any defense presented to you and your client denying payment other than the fact that Jim Marsh told her it was not compensable? Or is that it?
Well, and she also said, I did what I thought was right. I mean, those were the two prongs. That's why she denied it.
But she goes to no other outside expert source or anything. Jim right. Marsh is it.
Right. And she was asked, you'll see in the transcript on the second hearing on the attorney fees, do you have the opportunity to get an independent medical examination? Oh, yeah. Did you do that? No. Do you have the opportunity to contact counsel like Mr. Engel? Oh, yeah. But did you do that? No. Did you ask my client for a picture of his scar? Have you ever seen him? No.
In relation to that, is exhibit number 8, which is a picture of the young man after surgery, after the repair of the scar. But my question is it the ultimate repair of the scar, or is that a picture at prior to the final surgery?
Right. That's before the final surgery.
It is.
That's after he had his 18 stitches, but before. And there's one where it doesn't show up as well when he's looking head on, and there's one where he turns his head. That's it.
Right. That's exhibit number 8. So that's before the final surgery.
Right.
Okay.
Right. So you have Ms. Jobe armed with all these tools, armed with the legal knowledge, armed with the availability just to say, hey, what's this look like? And
out of curiosity, is she a lawyer?
No.
Okay.
But I don't know that you need to be a lawyer to tell that the scars disfigure me. But she's in charge of these claims. What's a little frightening is that in the responses to the discovery requests, she was asked, do you think this is disfiguring? They still asserted that it wasn't.
You know, I think that you get 3/4 of your argument left. I think that you can almost, I think for the purposes of argument, maybe you should assume you probably established the vexatious and unreasonable part, and now you probably should spend your time trying to get there as to legally.
Sure.
How do you get to recover for legal vexatious and unreasonable refusal?
Thank you. And just to be clear, the department didn't find it was vexatious. It just found that it was unreasonable, and it's one or the other.
Yeah, right.
The mechanism here then is, are attorney fees allowed against the state? That's the question. We look at these workman's comp statutes as a whole, and we find at the very beginning that employer shall include the state. And there's one of two ways of insuring here. It's either through an insurance company or through self-insurance. And the methods of securing compensation are outlined in 62-5. And therein, we find how to do it. And we also find that there's specific provisions in 62-5-6 and 62-5-7 that say this state need not furnish insurance or security under 62-5-1-5-5 or 62-5-10-12. What's 10? 62-5-10 talks about what self-insurers need to show to protect people out there, that they've got enough money in the bank, so to speak, to pay these claims. The state's exempted from that. But by very definition, the legislature has identified the state as someone, one, that must be an employer, and two, that is simply exempt from the bonding provisions and the security provisions of the statute. It doesn't say that the state's not a self-insurer. Finally, the state itself in its reply brief, when they talk about, you know, although they admitted that they were self-insured in their initial pleadings, and they didn't have a problem with that until, of course, we win, and now we're chasing them for fees. They said the state, it says in its brief, the state is self-insured in the sense that it carries the risk itself and does not purchase insurance from a third party. Well, if you look at the case of In Re Opinion of the Supreme Court or that Norwest Bank case, that's what we're talking about. That's self-insurance. They've decided to take on the risk itself. And if you read 3-12A34, the state shall provide for the amount necessary to make payments to the state employees' work and compensation program. and they talk about how that's to be done, and they identify the program premiums that are to be paid. So the discussion, we don't need to discuss sovereign immunity because this is the mechanism by which the state insures these employees.
What about Mr. Engel's comment then that attorney's fees are only authorized by Title 58 and the state is only self-insuring under 62? How do you melt those two provisions together?
Well, when we read 58.12.3 closely, it talks about that these fees are to be collected as part of the costs. As part of the cost of what? As part of the cost of the case. And this case arises under Title 62. And there in the provisions, I think it's 62.739 is the one for attorney's fees that talks about lawyers being allowed to get their costs and attorney's fees. So I think that's how it dovetails in. The suggestion that somehow that attorney fee, 25% of a recovery through settlement, 30% to the hearing, and 35% on appeal, to suggest that that somehow should cap these fees is wrong. Lawyers could not take these cases. The time I've gotten those affidavits, the time I had in this case, lawyers could not take these cases on $500 caps on teeth, on a couple thousand dollar fix on a surgery. Lawyers could not effectively or economically take these cases for claimants that were wrongfully denied if they didn't think.
Isn't that a policy decision, though, by the South Dakota legislature?
That's right, and I think they made it in 58.12.3 when they amended after Ofsted. And Your Honor wrote the dissent in Ofsted. After Ofsted, there was no question that that statute did not include self-insureds. They added self-insureds in the statute. And that's exactly what we're talking about here. Providing coverage for people that are out there. It's the smallest claims. I think Ms. Job testified that something in the neighborhood of 1,600 claims she gets a year. Well, if you don't have somebody watching over your shoulder and making sure that you're adjusting these claims reasonably, the magnitude of these claims might get to you, and you might have a tendency to deny unreasonably, as was done in this case.
Don't we have a case that says that the contingent fee is not binding, it's just guidance on these workman's comp cases? We had some kind of discussion on it once upon a time.
Well, the factors that have been cited about what are reasonable fees, one, I mean, among others, I think, is the time involved in the case. I do a fair amount of workman's compensation, and I've had decent success, but the time involved in this case is, as the court pointed out in an earlier question, It's just as much time as in many other cases. Now, this wasn't a five-week trial, but we had to prepare, we had to gather evidence, we had to get the experts, because the denial was a complete denial. They denied everything.
They resisted on every issue, I think.
Well, I mean,
it was solid opposition, wasn't it?
Well, yeah.
Do you have any idea? Is there anything in the record as to what the state has paid your counterpart here?
Well, no, I mean, no.
Okay, don't guess at it then. We'll go from there.
I assume his time has been reasonable, and certainly there must be a fund to pay him. I guess in closing, these cases are important to these folks out there who get wrongfully denied their claim. And without a mechanism, to suggest that there's no mechanism for recovery is a misreading of 52.12.3, and it's a misreading of the purpose of the statutory scheme. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Dorsey. Mr. Engel, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Mr. Engel, while you're getting your papers assembled.
When we deal with people fund cases, and I know this is not a people fund case, the legislature says right in the people fund statutes that this is, people fund is not insurance and is not considered to be insurance or under the jurisdiction of the insurance commissioner. So there we have a very clear statement by the legislature that this is not insurance. The legislature did no such thing in this case. Are we to draw something from that?
No, Your Honor, I don't believe so. I guess I would approach it from a different angle, and that would be that this court has said, I believe on a previous occasion, that in some circumstances, the purchase of liability insurance can act as a waiver of sovereign immunity. I think that the court needs to approach that as a sovereign immunity question. The people fund statutes, excuse me, talk about or provide for a very limited waiver of sovereign immunity, I believe, in some circumstances. And I don't want to get too far into this because this isn't my area of expertise, but I would submit, Your Honor, that it really doesn't, it's not relevant here and doesn't, the court shouldn't read anything into it because there still is no clear or express waiver of sovereign immunity in 58.12.3 as far as the state is concerned. One other issue I'd like to address, there are a couple of things, but I want to go back to something that Justice Meyer-Henry said earlier about the relationship of 62.5.4 and 62.5.6. As you'll recall, 62.5.4 was the statute that was referred to in 58.12.3. Employers who are self-insured pursuant to 62.5.4, that was the limitation. Well, prior to its repeal in 1996, 62.5.4 provided that an employer could comply with 62.5.1, which says you have to provide workers' compensation benefits through insurance or otherwise, by entering into an agreement with its employees agreeing to provide them benefits. The department would watch over that. There was no requirement for security. It was simply an agreement between the employer and its employees, which was regulated to a certain extent by the department, and the department would issue a certificate. If the employer didn't meet up or didn't meet its responsibilities, then the department could revoke the certificate, and the employer had to go buy liability insurance. 62.5.5 said that an employer could join an association. And I'm not sure exactly what that was intended to mean when it was adopted, but I presume some type of risk-sharing pool or something. So to respond to Justice Meyer-Henry's earlier concern, I think the reason in 1998, that self-insured employers, was limited to self-insured employers under 62.5.4, is because those employers perhaps were considered to be more likely to do something nefarious because it literally was coming out of their own pockets. There was no security. They didn't belong to an association. Nothing. It was based purely on their promise to pay. I think that's the answer to your question, Justice Meyer-Henry. The state still was clearly immune from that requirement, but I think that's the answer. Something else that Mr. Dorsey talked about was the fact that on these small claims, an attorney couldn't take them. And I agree that a lot of attorneys wouldn't take them. Perhaps the majority wouldn't take them. But I think that's true in a lot of cases. In other than workers' compensation settings, there are lots of cases where it's just not economical for a lawyer to take a case or for a client to hire a lawyer. That rationale in and of itself, I would submit, is not enough to turn SDCL 58.12.3 and the legislature's actions on it into something that they weren't intended to be. Now, also, I want to speak just briefly about the facts that, or the allegation that Lynn Jobe picked and chose and was didn't give Director Marsh all the necessary facts, as the department found. I think if the court looks at that carefully, you would find that that's an overstatement, and more than a bit of an overstatement by the department. For example, as to the scar revision surgery, the allegation is that Director Marsh was never told that Dr. Carver recommended this surgery. Well, that's true. That's not in the email. I mean, the court can see exactly what communications took place because it was all by email. However, I think it's reasonable for Director Marsh, who's been the director up there as long as I've been in town, so he's been here 16 or 18 years or something like that. I think it's reasonable to infer that he assumed someone wanted to have this covered. I think it's reasonable to infer that he presumed some doctor was saying this needs to happen. And I think it's also interesting to note that he didn't ask, well, has a doctor recommended this?
But isn't it reasonable also, Marsh is not medically trained, he's a lawyer, to, when you get this claim, say, well, we'll have our doctor look at him, or send us what you got, send us the pictures, and then we'll make a final decision. According to Mr. Dorsey, Ms. Jobe looked at Marsh's several sentence reply and said, oh, no coverage.
That's what did happen, Your Honor, is that Ms. Jobe gathered medical records. She had Dr. Carver's report. She did have medical records. She took those and made the inquiry to Director Marsh, who replied, you know, the model salesman dock worker reply.
So Marsh also looked at all the medical records?
No, Your Honor, he did not. Oh. Director Marsh would not have had those. But what I'm saying, Your Honor, is that Ms. Jobe didn't just get one sheet of paper, which was a claim, and read it, send Director Marsh an email, and deny the claim. This wasn't a two-minute procedure from start to finish. She did look at the records. As to the veneers on the teeth, she did more, I think. She made some calls to find out the purpose of veneers. She talked about the cosmetic purposes of veneers. She talked to his dentist, and again sent this email to Director Marsh. Now, the bottom line, of course, is that the department later ruled that Director Marsh's advice was wrong.
Well, when there's a disagreement, isn't it the employer's burden to show that the treatment is not reasonable or necessary?
Yes, Your Honor. That is the rule.
And did they produce any evidence at all that it was not reasonable or necessary in response?
Yes, Your Honor. As a matter of fact, we did. At the hearing on the merits, and let me back up here, it was not explicitly stated in Director Marsh's email, but I think that you can infer from it, and in fact it's the only way it makes sense, I guess, is that he was saying this isn't reasonable or necessary because it doesn't affect this person's wage earning capability. Okay. At the hearing on the merits, we talked about that. You know, has this affected this gentleman's ability to earn a wage? No. Is there any public relations aspect of his job? No. Has he lost out on a promotion? No. So in that sense, we did produce testimony. Was there medical testimony or dental testimony other than from his providers? No, there was not. I just don't want to leave the court with the impression that Ms. Jobe spent 30 seconds on each one of these decisions, because that's not the case. She did, and the record would show that she did spend time reviewing records, conferring with providers, conferred with Director Marsh, and made her decision. And unless the court has some other questions, my time's about up here. I don't have anything else. I thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The court will be in recess for approximately 10 minutes.